This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Okay, welcome back to Healing the Earth Radio here on CFRU. Was it Twin? Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the air. I spoke about you a little bit earlier, referenced a couple of interviews we've done in the past. But I wonder for new listeners out there and for old listeners, if you'd like to properly introduce yourself and maybe talk a bit about some of the work you've been doing at UVic and in your own home community since we last spoke.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, I'll tell everyone, Damakota, Dakota Ia Waziatwe, Emakiapie, Peji Hutazizik, Abi Makoche, Dechia, Tahawahie. And what I just told you was that I am Dakota, and in Dakota they call me Waziatwe, which translates in English as the woman of the north, and I told you that I come from the place where they dig for yellow medicine, and in English that place is known as the Upper Sioux Reservation, and it's located in southwestern Minnesota. And right now I also hold the Indigenous Peoples Research Chair in the Indigenous Governance Program at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. So I spend my time back and forth between my work in Victoria and my home community of Upper Sioux. Right now, I'm teaching out in Victoria within the Indigenous Governance Program, really focusing on strategies of decolonization, Indigenous liberation. I'm particularly interested in the recovery of Indigenous knowledge and also about how to survive the coming collapse.
Mm-hmm. In particular, I'm curious to hear from you maybe how what kind of growths in your consciousness you've been even excited about with regards to collapse, because that is certainly something many people talk about, and I guess I'm very interested to talk with you about the interconnections between decolonization from your place as a Dakota woman, basically living in exile, as you say, and I guess the need to respond or prepare for collapse and all that. I'm kind of curious to know how you've came to the place you've been recently.
Well, I think that certainly my perspective or my experience is really historically rooted. You know, and back in 1862, Dakota people went to war against the United States government and its citizens as a last attempt to try to save our homeland from invasion, to try to protect our land base, protect our people, and protect our culture. And we were very brutally defeated. I mean, our war didn't last long, but some painful consequences came out of that. One is that our people were forced into exile. We were first rounded up and placed in concentration camps. We were kept in those camps through the winter of 1862 and 63. In the spring of 1863, our people were forced out of our Minnesota homeland. We had a real spectacular event, which was the mass hanging of Dakota warriors in 1862, 38 of them, on December 26th, the day after Christmas of that year, in what remains the largest mass simultaneous hanging from one gallows in world history. And beginning in 1863, bounties were placed on the scalps of our people. Our treaties were unilaterally abrogated, which meant that the United States government not only did not fulfill its obligations in terms of the treaties, but also kept the land and, of course, all of the resources on the land. So that's the legacy, I think, that all Dakota people live with today. And because of that history, I think we've all been conditioned very much to believe that our serious resistance occurred in 1862 and that time is over. And the last several years, anyway, I've been doing a lot of reading and researching about peak oil and global collapse, global warming, all of those kinds of things that we know are occurring, we know are happening, and those things resonated with me in a very powerful way. I think that they're very much in line with many Indigenous oral traditions about the times to come. And so for Dakota people, we know that our nation is on the cusp of rebirth, that we're we have the potential to experience the rebirth of our nation, and that all of this seems to go hand in hand with the collapse of settler society or the people who invaded and colonized our lands. So I've been thinking about those things a lot, and I think I was taking a more benign position because of that historical consciousness where I believed that the collapse is coming, that it's inevitable, and in some ways we just need to wait it out. Like we need to survive this next wave and, you know, work on maintaining or reviving our culture, our traditions, our language, our spirituality, reacquainting ourselves with the land. And so what I would say is that most recently, what has been added to that mix, and I think largely influenced by people like Derek Jensen, is the urgency required, I think, for us to take down the civilization. And it was, I think, through reading Jensen's Endgame where it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I had read in, I would say, modified versions in various sources, especially in the collapse literature, peak oil literature, where it talks about the destruction that we experience every day on the planet. When we think about global climate change, what that means, the destruction of the natural world. Like, we know those things are happening. We all know those things are happening. But with Jensen's work, what clicked with me was this idea that if we don't take action to bring on collapse or to help facilitate the collapse of industrial civilization, that every day we wait further jeopardizes the survival of the planet. So not just the survival of human beings or plants and animals, but all life on the planet. And that has prompted me to kind of take my work in a new direction. I don't feel so much anymore like I can sit back, or that indigenous peoples generally can sit back and wait for these events to play out, that we actually have to become much more active about facilitating the process along, in the hope that all of us will have greater chances of survival in the future.
Yeah, I feel a lot of this really goes along with the work on decolonizing you're involved with, and the stuff we've talked about before about the importance of, I mean, there's different dynamics with myself as not being indigenous to this land and you as being indigenous to this land, but sort of there's a difference there, but also like just how you've talked about the importance of decolonizing one's mind. And I know you're recently talking about the need to kind of shed all these myths that have been kind of inculcated into our consciousness, myths about the legitimacy of the government or the permanence of it, myths of like faith and technological progress, and also myths of the moral purity of nonviolence and stuff like that too. I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about, almost how I'd think that decolonizing one's mind inherently kind of like leads one to similar assumptions, which would hopefully be assets in the kind of like needing to take action that you're talking about.
Right, and I think that I'm, again, decolonization, I think, is so important to think about as a process that, you know, we hope that there will be some kind of endpoint where we might all be decolonized, but that mostly for us right now, for our purposes, it's more helpful to think of it as a process. And the process, I think, once you kind of have the critical consciousness so that you can deconstruct the myths that we've all been raised with, it opens the opportunity to see things in a new way or to see new possibilities. I think that the issue of violence is one that I'm wrestled with, and I think a lot of it, as I mentioned before, about the historical consciousness that's distinctive to Dakota people because of our experiences has left us with a particular view about violence. And even today, we have many Dakota people, for example, who claim their loyalty to the United States government from 1862 forward, that they celebrate the fact that they align themselves with the United States government and its citizens rather than taking up arms in defense of Dakota people and Dakota lands against the United States government and its citizens. And part of it is because the repercussions against those people who fought back were so extreme that people wanted to distance themselves from those actions and still today want to distance themselves from those actions. So we know that if we, I guess I would say, push our resistance to a certain level, that the United States government cracks down very hard. And we saw the extreme consequences of that back in the 19th century, consequences that we're still very much living with today, the most important one being the disconnection from our homeland, because most of our people still live in exile. So we only have small populations living within Minnesota, and we don't have access to what is our birthright or our inheritance. So there's this fear, and it's very deep-seated, that if we were to take up arms, for example, against the United States government, that not only would we be brutally beaten, but that it might very well mean the extinction of our people. So that's a reality. That's one of the realities that we face. And for us, part of the decolonization process, I think, requires us to question that and explore the options, explore the meaning of that. You know, if we aren't willing, for example, to take action in defense of our land, what we're saying is that our lives, our human lives, are more important than the life of other beings that existing in our homeland. And I think that at one time our ancestors never would have separated ourselves from the natural world, that we would have considered all of these beings our relatives. And in rhetoric, we still do today. But very rarely do we live out that rhetoric. Very rarely do we actually show in our daily lives that we value the earth and all of its beings as relatives, or as much as we might value our own lives, our own place within our homeland. So I think that these are hard issues to wrestle with for Indigenous peoples, and I guess an accompanying problem when Indigenous peoples think about defense in the most serious way, in defense of the land. One of the realities is that, you know, we've been cannon fodder for American wars of imperialism all over the world. And I don't want to be in a situation again where Indigenous peoples are the only ones on the first line of attack, even though I know that that's a very real possibility. But one of the questions I try to ask Indigenous people right now, which is a very uncomfortable question, a question in some way, is, are we still defenders of the land? And if we are, if we're going to espouse the beautiful rhetoric about reflecting our cosmological beliefs, for example, in Dakota tradition, we would say, Midakiapi Owaski, all my relations, all my relatives. And if we really believe that, and if we really believe that Indigenous peoples have been and are defenders of the land, then we need to live that ethic. We need to live that that belief and put it into practice. But they're not easy things.
Imagine, as important as your words are, I imagine they're very challenging for a lot of people, because you're asking really tough questions that it's easy to not consider as seriously as you're encouraging people to consider them.
Right.
I was just wondering something, and you don't have to comment on this a whole lot, but for better or worse, the majority of listeners out there, or readers, or whoever in the future, will be not native to this land, but many of whom are very much very interested in what you're talking about. And I know, actually, over the years since me and you have last spoken a couple times, or the two interviews we did, your interview comes up as the one I get most positive feedback about. People seem to really appreciate encouraging people to like really envision, you know, like a long-term decolonization strategy in most. And I don't know if it's different. I sense a difference between the north of the Canadian-U.S. border, and that there's like many different kind of like, you know, slowly radicalizing like anti-colonial analyses and the connections between environmentalism, environmental justice, social justice, and anti-colonial work are very strong in many different places. There's lots of, for example, non-Native communities surrounding Six Nations or Tiwananega who work in tandem with as much as they can or participate similarly in their own land defense and their own communities. And so I guess I'm just wondering, for people like that who are actively or even much less actively involved and just curious or very interested, do you have many thoughts on the role non-Native people could have? I mean, some people have been actively colonizing societies for centuries now, or if not longer. Do you have any thoughts on the role people like that could play in the stuff you're talking about, the need to defend the land, the need to maybe work in alliance with indigenous communities or anything like that?
Right. Well, I think that there are a lot of possibilities, and you're right. I think in the United States there are very few people who are really willing or interested in engaging anti-colonial work. There are pockets around, and one of those pockets, fortunately, is in the Twin Cities metro area here. And so just to give you an example of a way that we've been working with this particular group, they went through a kind of a training workshop course last spring, and coming out of that decided that they wanted to continue meeting and they wanted to continue to work towards decolonization and support of indigenous, well, in particular, Dakota struggle for liberation. So they continued meeting. They formed an organization calling themselves Unsettling Minnesota, and they're now working on projects that will support Dakota reclamation of land and Dakota liberation. So, for example, one of the events that they hosted last December in 2009 was an evening of reparations. And when I heard about what they were doing, I was so excited, but it made me chuckle because I thought, well, this is very interesting. Who's going to show up to kind of a banquet dinner fundraiser like this? And as it turns out, they had several dozen people, I think, who showed up, and it was an opportunity for people to make contributions to a Dakota land project. This project would involve raising funds so that we can buy back land that can be used for Dakota purposes, especially to work towards things like food security. We want wild ricing and sugar bushing lands. We'd like a place where Dakota people could gather, could camp, could even live, and practice Dakota ways of life and ways of being there. So a place that would be a source of kind of cultural information, living close to the land, living sustainably. Some of the ideas that I outline in my last book project, What Does Justice Look Like? So it was so exciting to think that there's a non-Indigenous group willing to put their time and energy into raising funds for this Dakota land project. And in the past, I've really rejected the idea that Dakota people should have to buy back land that was stolen from us in the first place. That a lot of my work has centered around the issue of justice. And in that particular context, us buying back land that was stolen from us does not represent justice by any means. So I didn't want that to be a strategy for Dakota people to employ, but for non-Indigenous people, for settlers to engage in buying back land that they then turn over to Dakota people is a whole nother thing. And I'm totally comfortable with that idea in terms of an act of reparative justice from this settler organization to Dakota people. So they've begun their fundraising. We're continuing to work on that, and we're hoping that within the next few years anyway that we can purchase at least 40 acres of land that can be used for traditional food gathering purposes. So that's one way that this particular group is helping to support Dakota people, and it's a very important move. I guess part of what I've realized in the last few years too is that because Dakota people are denied a homeland or denied a space within our homeland, when these changes come, when food security becomes a major issue, that it's like another death sentence for our people. The community that I come from right now, Upper Sioux, has about 1,500 acres in the Minnesota River Valley, but most of it is bluff and floodplain. And we don't produce our own food. We don't have a source of food here, really. And the food sources of food that we do have that our people used to depend on, like the fish, for example, in the Minnesota River, now they can't eat it because it's toxic. So what that means is that if we as a community had to rely on our land base to provide food for our people, we would starve. And that's our future, literally, if we don't have a larger land base. So land reclamation then becomes that much more important in this particular context. And that's a really fundamental way that settlers can help give back to indigenous populations.
I also imagine there can be some crossover between people who come from more of an anarchist perspective who also want to, who also believe life can, perhaps will be so much better without the various institutions of these very, like, hegemonic governments and all that. I guess I know particular communities who come from that perspective where that is one potential kind of crossover.
It's, you know, and that's an important crossover point. I was giving a talk a few weeks ago at the University of Minnesota, and in the question and answer, as these things started coming up, this was an issue. This was a kind of question. And what I said at the time is that it's been much easier to work with anarchist populations because they aren't invested in maintaining the state. And it's not that there aren't other issues that we have to deal with, I think, with in anarchist circles, but that anti-statist position that's fundamental is really something that supports indigenous liberation like liberals can't. And so in this talk, in the question and answer, one of the questions came up is, you know, well, what about people who don't want or who want the United States to continue? And I finally said, look, you can't support the United States government and support indigenous liberation. Like, they don't go hand in hand. If you want to support Dakota people, you can't get all weepy when you see the American flag being unfurled, you know. You have to understand that this has been the most violent, destructive nation to indigenous lands and peoples. And if you believe that, if you understand how destructive it's been, and you continue to support it, then you can't be an ally. And I know that it's, you know, that's difficult, especially for the more liberal sectors of society, because they're still invested.
It's a tricky one, but I think, yeah, I hope people, as many people as possible, I guess, are hopefully are willing to be open to that unlearning that needs to happen, because it does happen eventually. Well, for some people, if you're willing, I guess. It's a tricky one, and yeah, I think you put it really well. I guess I'm kind of curious to know if we want to talk about some more of the stuff from the section you're working on for the second volume, Indigenous Minds Only. In particular, I was interested in what you lay out as an Indigenous Action Plan, and I was interested in it because it's concise but also, like, pretty comprehensive, and it starts off with a spiritual and cultural foundation and ends with defending the land at all costs. And I wonder if you were interested in going into some of the steps in there.
Right, I'd be happy to. Well, you know, with the issue of collapse and, I think, preparations, I've been thinking about that very much, obviously, in the Dakota context, because it's the Dakota community that I'm most concerned about, because that's my, you know, our lands, our people, and I'd like to see us survive into the future. But I know that when we begin to think about these issues that are happening, that it's very important for us, first of all, to get the grounding within our culture and within our spirituality. And I think part of it is reestablishing our relationship with our homelands and taking the time to understand how our homeland has suffered and will continue to suffer unless we begin to take other kinds of actions. And I also think that our traditions are pretty useful when I think about how we need to go about carrying on our lives and the kinds of relationships or interaction that we should have with all of creation. And so I encourage that as the first and most important step, I think, in developing an Indigenous action plan. The other steps I talk about are things like, you know, developing a culture of resistance in preparation for action. I do recommend that communities arm ourselves. I talk about the need for building lifeboats, both, assuming you can work on lifeboat building to some extent if you have a sufficient land base. If you don't have a sufficient land base, as in the case of Dakota people in Minnesota, then reclamation of land becomes essential for our future survival. And then I talk about working to dismantle the existing structure. That means helping to bring on collapse by attacking the systems and institutions that we're all exposed to. That's essentially a really important part of the decolonization process, is overturning all of those systems and institutions. And lastly, defending the land at all costs. And I have that last not because you don't do that until the end, but because I think it's the most important thing that we have to keep at the forefront of our minds, our hearts, and our actions all the way through this process, that we can't ever forget that our relationship is to a particular geography, to all of the beings, all the plants, all the animals, to the land, to the waters, and that it's our job to protect those beings that we have this ancient relationship with, and that we remember our priorities and responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the different steps that I set out, and I just had the opportunity in the last few weeks to talk about these ideas within my own community, and it wasn't a well-attended event. I don't think that a lot of Indigenous individuals or communities are really ready to engage in a lot of these discussions. But it's interesting that the people who were there and the people who are interested in engaging these discussions are very much on board. I think that they really understand the need to engage in all of these activities if we take seriously concerns about the future, particularly climate change, particularly the end of oil, and the ongoing destruction of our homelands.
I imagine, too, that with each of those, there's a place for many different people and many different kinds of willingness and many different kinds of actions. I'm curious to know, I guess, where you think, I don't know, how are things going, you think, in your own community? Do you think that, are you trying to meet people where they're at? Are you just trying to, and work from there? Are you trying to really get going in, like, more tangible ways?
Well, I think that at one point, and I think even a few years ago, I would have said we need to meet people where they're at. And the sense of urgency I feel right now no longer allows for that. And I know that, like I said, a lot of people in my community aren't necessarily ready to engage these discussions, and that's okay. But some of us have to, and some of us have to prepare. And I think that the rest of the people will start to come on board as the crisis deepens, as it becomes more and more apparent that we're headed for destruction, or that this society as we know it is headed for destruction, and we need to think about alternatives. That my hope is at that point other community members will come forward and join in the work that we've been doing. So in the meantime, we're working to develop our skills, our understandings, our capacity towards self-sufficiency. We're working on developing a culture of resistance, and that's very slow, very time-consuming work.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any way to get around that,
yeah.
But we are trying to increase that critical consciousness So, you know, part of my work in doing that is engaging in researching and writing for the moment, providing a forum for discussions or trying to bring people into discussions, creating awareness through newspapers, T-shirt designs, talking about how we can start to think about things differently. And it's all of that right now, it feels like it's really about planting seeds. It's not about seeing any major transformation. I quite honestly don't think that transformation will come until the crisis hits.
Mm-hmm.
Personally.
Yeah, I know in What We Leave Behind by Derek Jensen and Eric McVeigh, they define a culture of resistance as a group of people with an understanding of the root causes of their predicament and a willingness to work together in opposition to authority to address those causes. So I guess to get to the place where there's a group of people with an understanding of the root causes, that's very difficult in a very colonized society.
And
a willingness to work together in opposition to authority is also challenging beyond that.
Right.
And it does take that kind of long, it takes long work, a long time.
It sure does. It sure does. So that's the stage we're in right now. And it doesn't mean that we aren't working on those other aspects. But right now, I think in trying to build a collective movement is it's going to take a lot of effort.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'm particularly interested in is how you frame a lot of your steps with this Indigenous Action Plan as potentially being made more possible, or at least with the collapse of North American like industrial society, that might open up avenues or more potential for reclamation of land, in particular if there are coordinated actions and stuff like that. I wonder if you're interested in talking about, I don't know, some of the ways these things play out, and maybe if people see that as kind of like a suicide mission to try to take over land right now or whatever is needed to build up one's land base, maybe how there might be some kind of, I just wonder if you want to talk more about the potential that might come in the future if the dominant nation state is taken up by other crises or doesn't have the ability to organize military power or stuff like that.
Right. Well, I think that one of the issues for me has been, I should say, this is why I think I was drawn to the collapse literature to begin with, and that's because I've been waiting my whole life for the collapse of industrial civilization. I've been waiting for the vindication of indigenous ways of being, indigenous life forms, and I feel like we're on the cusp of that right now. And so all of this, like this time period, is very exciting to me, and I know that we're entering a very dangerous, very volatile period, and there will be a lot of scary things accompanying that, but I also think that this is the point in time that will allow for the rebirth of our people. So as I began kind of reading a lot of the literature and thinking about where are the windows of opportunity for indigenous populations here, I realized that the opportunities are going to be many and varied as time goes on, that what becomes impossible for us as an individual, very small, marginalized community within our homeland to resist in a fundamental way becomes much more realistic in the context of collapse. So as the United States government or the Canadian government becomes more and more threatened or dysfunctional or unable to function because of lack of access to cheap oil, for example, the systems are going to start to break down on their own. And because we're all so dependent on cheap oil, cheap energy right now, that when it even becomes more expensive, it's going to be much harder to maintain this way of life. And I think in that particular context that indigenous populations have an opportunity to work perhaps in concert or even individually as to take advantage of that crisis. And so one of my colleagues at the University of Victoria last spring made the comment, may a thousand okas bloom, and the idea being that if indigenous peoples all are taking resistance actions within their own home territories, that it will be much more difficult for settler society, the Canadian government, the United States government, to continue to take actions to suppress us. And that's very unusual in our history. So we have very unique opportunities right now. We just need to learn to recognize them, and we need to be prepared for them so that when they do arrive, so that when they are here, we're prepared to take action immediately.
Mm-hmm. I think that is, it seems to be such a rational approach to things. It's very, you know, well-researched, and I know I brought a good friend and a colleague of Derek Jensen, Eric McBee, to town in January to talk about the same kind of stuff, the need to build cultures of resistance, the need to think beyond conventional activism and stuff like that. And what people always leave from that is that they always say it's just, they're so impressed with how rational of an approach it is. It just takes information in, looks honestly at our situation, and then looks at what are the potential courses of action which offer the greatest hope for survival. And I guess I really appreciate you laying it out as you have, because I find it very refreshing and free of, I don't know, a lot of the myths you talked about the earlier part of the interview. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, I very much admire the work of Eric McBee as well, and I think all of it is rational. What's insane or what's irrational is the way that we've interacted with this land for so long, particularly settler society, but certainly Indigenous populations are now a part of that as well, and that's the insane, that's the irrational part. So I think that in some ways we have the easier job in terms of our project, in that we just need to follow the logic. You know, we need to follow that trail because it's there, but following it is a whole other thing.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I was curious to ask, if you don't mind, is how this affects different kinds of work, like the truth-telling kind of stuff you used to be involved with, or maybe you still are involved with. Like that, remember when we spoke about that earlier in an earlier interview, you spoke of that as being like, you know, a multi-generational process and all that kind of stuff. So I'm just kind of curious to know if the urgency that is so obviously required, if that, how that affects your thoughts on any kind of place for truth-telling initiatives and that kind of cultural reparation work.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, my last book project, What Does Justice Look Like, was really about advocating for this truth-telling agenda as one of the first steps or stages in working towards justice for Dakota people within our homeland. And at the time, I knew I was struggling with it because I was writing that book in the context of this Minnesota sesquicentennial celebration. And I knew even within that context that we had taken the time to go meet with the sesquicentennial commissioners, to educate them, to talk about this painful history for Dakota people and what their celebration of it meant in terms of morality, in terms of ethics, in terms of justice, and in terms of settler-Indigenous relations. And in that context, they just ignored us, that in the end they decided that they wanted to continue on with their Minnesota birthday party and that everything we had shared with them was irrelevant to that discussion. And so those are the kinds of experiences that I've had, and I'm a professional educator, and so there's a big part of me that has believed for a long time that if we simply educate people, that if they simply know the truth, that it will affect their actions. And as time goes on, I believe that less and less. I think that there's a small percentage of people who are affected by the facts or the truth or by the logic, but the vast majority of people do not allow the truth to impact their behavior, but it may, in fact, even entrench them further in their original beliefs. So when I laid out that project with truth-telling as a component, it was really keeping in mind or believing that if we have many generations, that this is a long-term project we might be able to accomplish. And maybe if we had another couple hundred years, that would be a possibility. But given the sense of urgency that I feel right now, I don't believe that we have time to convince everyone about the need for justice or about the need for decolonization or about the need to protect the land base. I think we're too far into this trajectory for people's minds to be changed with the truth or even with the logic. So right now, I think that we're just going to have to take the steps to bring on the crisis so that this way of life collapses. And at that point, people might be more receptive to alternatives. And I guess that's where I'm putting my hope right now.
I know that can be a challenging thing for many people who believe in the need for mass popular support and stuff like that. And I often find that an honest, you know, unflinching like recognition or look into how bad climate collapse is and all that kind of stuff, that usually goes along with, a similar recognition that we can't wait for everyone because, as it ever takes several hundred years for one thing, but we don't have the time, and the planet needs us, and our own lives and futures need us too. And I know I've been impacted by someone else I interviewed. I mentioned to you Craig Chalquist, who has worked a lot with violent offenders who are kind of forced to come to him as a therapist. And people particularly in abusive relationships, and that allowed him to not have to have this kind of naivete towards those in power, that if you just give them enough information, then of course they're going to change their direction. Right. What he's really sees as important for as many people as possible to recognize is that those in power are very conscious of what they're doing, and the rewards and the benefits are very much worth it to them for now, although it seems insane when you think about the futures. But also, I was just reading or talking the other day about how many rich, like ultra elite families in the States are buying up property elsewhere in the world. They don't have their primary homes in the States anymore, or they have at least second homes elsewhere. And I find that's kind of interesting too, how those with the money to do so are buying property elsewhere because they see things going downhill. And I think that it just goes to show further that those at the top of things know what's happening. And no amount of education or moral persuasion will change their ways. It's a tough thing to come to for some people, but it seems to be true. And you say that as well in this section you forwarded to me, when you say an honest reading of the historical record suggests that our efforts to appeal to the goodwill of society have failed. And it's not a very nice thing to consider, but I think it is true.
Yeah, it's depressing.
Yeah.
But I think it is true, and the sooner, for me, I think it's been actually liberating to abandon that, because I've been taught, I think, in so strongly in the power of education to transform, and so that should be the first course of action. And what I'm realizing is that it probably doesn't make much of a difference in the end. That there will be a small minority who will be persuaded, and so it's worth trying to reach them. But for the vast majority of people, it's not going to make any difference.
Mm-hmm. And it makes me think of Sean Brandt of the Mohawk Thanganega Territory up here just north of Lake Ontario. Maybe you're familiar with him. He's been kind of, unfortunately, he was, for better or worse, he was made very public around road blockades and rail blockades and stuff like that. And he was talking about how he gave up on society like 10 years ago, he said, when he realized that, you know, it was very, very public all throughout mainstream Canadian news. The dire situation on drinking water on reserves, the fact children are being put to bed with sores on their bodies from the water coming out of their homes, and no one's doing anything about it. And he said when he realized just how wide, you know, he really honestly looked at how widespread the information is, the facts are out there all over Canadian society that reserve communities are in deplorable conditions, but nothing's changing. And it took him a number of years to really realize, like, you just have to give up on, in his words, he gave up on society a long time ago and just does what he has to do and does what's right.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's a very important point. And, you know, and when we were in 2008 kind of protesting a lot of the sesquicentennial activities in the state of Minnesota, that one of the accusations that people would throw our way was that we should have tried other means, that protesting doesn't solve anything. And, you know, in some ways, they're right in that all the protesting we did, I don't think, made any difference in terms of the outcome of the sesquicentennial celebration. So that part is right. But the other part that really always bothered me was people assumed that that was our first course of action, and not realizing that, you know, these are things that I teach about, I write about, I'd given presentations about, I tried to intervene at the early stages to affect the decision-making process, I wrote letters, we took all kinds of actions, and when we were finally out in the street, it was after engaging in all of those other actions, and those were the only actions that provoked any large-scale discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that we really have to think carefully about our actions. And in some ways, we can talk about these things, but it really has to occur on an individual level. Like, an individual has to feel like they've exhausted other avenues, or they have to determine for themselves that point where they abandon hope in a particular strategy or in the capacity for society to do the right thing. And for me, that was a learning lesson. I needed to go through that process so that I could see, just what the state would do to silence me or to suppress my voice when all I was doing was engaging in truth-telling. I wasn't engaging in any acts of violence. And that, in the end, that had very little effect anyway. So what are the other options? And now I'm ready to look at those other options. But I don't think I would have been at this point had I not gone through that.
Hmm. Very, very interesting. Uzia Twin, we've only got a few minutes left, and I wonder if you'd like to share some closing words, if you have anything you'd like to wrap things up for the listeners out there. And we've went over a whole lot of different topics here, but I wonder how you'd like to close things.
Well, I guess I would just also like to encourage people to take action. I know that it's very scary to think about putting our lives in a different direction or to take risks where we might jeopardize the safety of ourselves or our families, our communities. But I think the circumstances are so dire right now that we really need to set our fears aside. We need to, or I don't even want to say set them aside, we need to learn to live with those fears and act in spite of them. And also that, and again, I think this is one of the lessons from the protesting in 2008, was that all behaviors will become criminalized at some point if they're sufficiently threatening the state. And so, you know, even if you aren't willing to take up arms, that's okay. But you have to know that even if you're providing food for a resistance movement, that will become criminalized. You know, one of the events here that occurred in the last few years was with the RNC8, the people who've been charged for interrupting the Republican National Convention in St. Paul in 2008. And so they're still going through the court process right now. But one of the people charged was organizing for food, not bombs. And so even providing food for anarchists in that case became criminalized. And so people have to know that even if you aren't taking up arms, your behavior, if you're supporting a resistance movement, will be criminalized. And so people just need to understand that and need to be willing to risk something. The change isn't going to come without risk.
Uzia Twin, it's been so great talking with you. I really appreciate you sharing your time.
Well, thank you for having me, Matt. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Take good care and good luck with the next volume, Indigenous Minds Only.
All right. Thank you very much.
Right on. Thanks, Waz. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.